Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Allison Jones Lockwood is a mother and victim advocate from Colorado. Her career in aiding survivors began years ago while she was in college and continues to this day. Although her journey recently pivoted when she became executive director of the Rape Crisis Center for Northern Colorado, at the time of our recording, she worked with EVAWI, or End Violence Against Women International. The Broken Cycle Media team is grateful Allison was able to offer such a broad perspective of the advocacy arena, as well as a detailed account of what's coming next for EVAWI, as the organization continues their work to change the criminal justice and legal landscapes for victims. And although the importance of advocacy work is always relevant, this conversation is especially timely, considering October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
I'm Allison Jones Lockwood. I define myself as an advocate, as a mom, a hiker and runner, someone who lives in the beautiful Rocky Mountains.
I am the executive director of SAVA Center. SAVA stands for Sexual Assault Victim Advocate, and SAVA Center is the rape crisis center for Northern Colorado. We serve two counties, Larimer and Weld County, and we provide advocacy services, clinical services, and prevention education and outreach.
I kind of stumbled into the advocacy field. In college, I was seeking a degree in elementary education, which I have never used formally. But during my time there, I was a sexual health peer educator. I went around to different residence halls, fraternities, and sororities and talked about sexual health. And it became this natural fit. We would start to partner with the Women's Center because the Women's Center was also doing awareness education on campus in terms of sexual assault. They just really made sense in my brain that we would merge our efforts and talk about this bigger picture of sexual health, consent, sexual assault. I graduated from college knowing that I definitely did not want to teach elementary education, but I knew that I wanted to use my degree in education in some way. I got married shortly after college. I moved to San Diego. My now ex-husband was in the military, and that connection and the experience in college with the peer education is what helped me get my very first job with the United States Navy. I was a civilian employee of the Fleet and Family Support Center. My job was to go around to ship and shore commands and provide awareness education on sexual assault. That was about 50% of my job. The other 50% was managing the victim advocacy program, training victim advocates, making sure that when an active duty military member presented at a hospital for a forensic exam, that we had advocates that would be there with them. If there was no advocate, then I was the default on-call advocate. I remember the very first time I ever responded to the hospital for a survivor who was there for a forensic exam. She was an active duty military member. This was a military hospital. I remember it down to the detail of the social worker who greeted me. It was Jeannie Ertl. I will never forget her name. I will never forget the way she looked. She's also the first person who ever introduced me to EMDR. And this was 24 years ago. I remember looking in Jeannie Ertl's eyes. She could see the terror on my face as a first-time brand new advocate. She put her arms on my shoulders and she just said, "You're going to be great. Just go in there." And I kind of took that same mentality with advocates as I trained them, because I remember what it felt like walking in that room. I remember what it felt like sharing space for the very first time with a survivor. I remember this particular person was completely unsure of what she wanted to do. And she was only at the emergency room because she had some pretty severe injuries as a result of the sexual assault that she experienced. This was a sexual assault by a dating partner. It was really about, let's just check your body out. Let's make sure your body is okay. Let's figure out what's going on with these injuries. Remember that aspect of, I'm going to break this down into manageable pieces for this particular person. Right then and there, we were able to get through that part of making sure her body was okay. She left with the understanding that if she decided to report, she would reach out for help. It was shortly after that she did want to report, so I met her to start the report process. We got there, we had checked in with each other, we had been talking with each other. She's smoking cigarette after cigarette, trying to get herself ready for this, and we never made it inside the building. That was okay. And I kept telling her over and over again, you don't have to walk in there, you don't have to do anything beyond this. Everything you do from this point on is your choice. Over the years, as I've trained advocates, I think of Jeannie Ertl a lot. That mindset of, we break it down into manageable pieces and parts. We share space with someone. We distract them if that's what they want. We answer their questions. What I have found that I do more than anything else is sit in silence and being 100% comfortable with just sitting in silence. It's letting the survivor know if they want to talk, I will talk to them. I'm happy to talk to them. I will talk about the weather. I'll talk about movies. I'll talk about God knows what that they want to talk about. But if they don't want to talk, they just want someone there, then I will be that person who is sitting there with them. I like to describe the role of the advocate as the link. I'm going to use a bicycle wheel as an example. You picture the wheel, you've got the tire, and the tire spins round and round and round. I put the criminal justice professionals on that tire piece. So you have your police officer, your detective, you have the prosecutor. I'm even going to throw crime lab on there. So you have the victim at the very center where the wheel is going round and round and round the victim. But the advocate is the piece that connects the spoke to the wheel part. They are the main role that ensures the victim stays connected to the process that is spinning around them. Oftentimes, professionals are, rightly so, busy doing their job, investigating, prosecuting, examining, and that leaves little time to really focus on the survivor, making sure they feel connected, making sure their questions are answered. That ultimately is the role of the advocate. We have community-based advocates and we have system-based advocates, and every community is a little bit different. A community-based advocate might be activated to be there during the forensic exam. Then maybe a system advocate at the police department takes over. They stay in contact throughout the investigation. And then maybe there's another system-based advocate at the prosecutor's office. In some communities, it's more of the community-based advocate who stays connected throughout the entire process. In some communities, both community and system-based advocates are working together. That's the ideal model. because the system-based advocate is working for law enforcement or the prosecutor's office. And so they have a great connection to upcoming appointments, court dates, that kind of thing. Whereas the community-based advocate has the added layer of confidentiality. For example, a system-based advocate doesn't have quite as strong of a confidentiality protection. The community-based advocate is also going to be very, very well tapped into what services are available in the community. It's really important for advocates to always remember that there is an entire whole person outside of the victimization. That entire person likely needs resources and support in other aspects. For example, let's say the survivor was raped in their apartment and they just cannot bear to go back to that apartment. That's an aspect of advocacy where the advocate can step in, meet with the landlord, explain the situation. Of course, this is with a written release of information from the victim. I want to make sure that's very, very clear that this is with victim permission, but also their written permission as well. Maybe the advocate can help get this person out of their lease. Maybe they are a college student and they just cannot face going back to class the next day. Again, with permission, it might be reaching out to an academic advisor, explaining the situation and seeing if there can be some leeway there. Maybe they're a high school student and it's reaching out to the high school principal. Maybe they have some health consequences as a direct result. Maybe there's injuries and they have a follow-up medical appointment. That's something that that advocate could accompany them to. So there's so many different aspects of advocacy that are within, adjacent, and completely unrelated to the criminal justice system. One of the key tenets of advocacy is trying to connect and understand that whole person. That really is where they understand all of the individual unique needs that each and every survivor might have. Another important piece to consider is everything that I've just explained is what I would call direct advocacy. So this is working one-on-one with one direct person. All advocates need to remember that there is a bigger picture going on. That is more of what I would call that system level of advocacy. This is different from a system-based advocate. When I'm talking about systemic level advocacy, I'm talking about the relationships between the advocacy organization and the police department, between the advocacy organization and the sexual assault nurse examiner facility, between the prosecuting attorney's office. It's ensuring that those relationships are paid attention to, because we really aren't doing our full job if we're not looking at that macro level view. We have to see both at macro and micro level at all times. One of the best examples of how we balance direct and systemic advocacy is a situation that unfortunately is happening all too often. It's the situation where a victim advocate is, let's say, in the interview room with a detective, with a survivor, and things aren't really going right. This could be for a number of different reasons, whether it could be something like the advocate can tell that law enforcement doesn't believe the survivor, or the survivor is frustrated with the reception that they're getting. When the advocate is in this particular situation, they're prioritizing this direct person they're working with, but they also have to look at this bigger picture and this relationship with this system. So how do we balance that? The best thing and the first thing that the advocate can do is ask the survivor, would it be okay if we take a 5-minute break? Asking the survivor gives them a chance to ask the survivor, do you have any concerns or any questions, to kind of assess where the survivor's at, because we certainly don't want to assign emotion to the survivor. We don't want to create a situation that isn't there necessarily. I do want to have one word of caution. Many police departments record the victim interview. And this is actually something that Ivawi recommends. We recommend that interviews are recorded because it allows the officer to focus more on listening to the victim as opposed to taking furious notes. However, if the advocate and the survivor take a break. And if the interview is being recorded, the advocate needs to be mindful that if they take that break in that room and the recording is going, it is all being recorded. So I want all advocates to be very mindful anytime there is a recording and they take a break that the advocate and the survivor need to leave that room. Sometimes the interviews change. Victims become suspects, and it is part of the advocate's role to recognize that, to advocate for the survivor on their behalf if they want us to. We can also support them advocating on their own behalf. One of the things that some advocates miss a little bit is that sometimes survivors can and want to speak up for themselves, and we should not speak up for them when they don't want us to or when they can do it themselves. Every advocacy program is a little bit different, and every state has different guidelines. Most programs in the Midwest that I've worked with or just spoken to, their trainings are around 40 hours. When I was working back in Kansas and Missouri, I was part of the committees that set the training standards for both of the states. Both states settled on 40 hours. We did this with the understanding that many, many programs in those two states are rural programs. Rural programs are understaffed. They cover very, very large service areas. There's one program in Kansas that covers 17 counties in northwestern Kansas. That's a massive service area. To bring volunteers together before we had virtual training opportunities for 72 hours would have been completely unmanageable and unrealistic. But we felt like 40 hours was a good baseline for either standalone rape crisis centers or for dual sexual assault domestic violence programs. A lot of the information covers both. Crisis intervention is always going to be the basics of crisis intervention. The role of the advocate is always going to be what an advocate should do. Now, are there differences when you're at the hospital after somebody's been sexually assaulted, or if you respond to a scene after a domestic violence incident? There are some very nuances to those two roles, but the mechanics, the basics are the same. I really believe we should not have a large burden on advocates to become advocates. I think 40 hours is absolutely sufficient. Some states have certification processes. There are some that provide credentialing for victim advocates. NOVA does provide victim advocacy training. Because I come from local programs, I will always recommend that anybody who wants to be an advocate start by looking at their local program. You can start with a Google search of the local rape crisis center or domestic violence program in your area, because every single program needs volunteers. Volunteers are a wonderful addition to every sexual assault response team. Maybe you start with a crisis line if you're unsure about being in the hospital. Maybe you volunteer for the domestic violence shelter. There's so many different ways to get involved and so many different needs. From there, if you volunteer and you think, maybe I want to do this as a career, then you look for the next opportunity. Going through that volunteer victim advocacy training is going to be a great way to get started. I had a lot of really great experiences while I was working with the military. I got to go to sea for a week. I sailed from San Diego to Hawaii, and we provided training to a battle group. To get from ship to ship, we had to take a helicopter. There were three ships total within the battle group, and it was an incredible experience to live and provide education in their environment. After about a year in that position, I transitioned to the Rape Crisis Center in San Diego, called Center for Community Solutions. My role was similar yet different. My title was volunteer coordinator, but I really was so much more than that. I was supervising advocates, training advocates. I also added this community education aspect to my role under the umbrella of trying to recruit volunteers, but also trying to continue that awareness education piece that had been so important to me in the beginning of my career. I was in that role for about 2 years, and then got divorced, moved back to the Kansas City area where I had grown up. Kansas City is a unique community. It covers both sides of the state line. There are counties in Kansas and counties in Missouri. There are over 54 police jurisdictions within the Kansas City metropolitan area. There are over a dozen SANE programs just in the Kansas City metropolitan area. So it's a massive, massive service area that covers a very large geographical area and a lot of requests for advocacy. I then joined an organization called MOXA. MOXA is the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. I started out as a volunteer coordinator and I worked my way up to a director of advocacy. When I joined MOXA, they offered a 24-hour crisis line. They offered 24-hour hospital advocacy, but the advocates were not utilized in the way that I believed they could and should be. Advocates were not routinely called to respond to the hospital for every exam. So we went from about 120 requests for hospital advocacy per year when I joined the organization in 2004 to, in the past few years, they've been well over 600, upwards of 800 per year. We were also not routinely in the interview room during law enforcement victim interviews. Now MOXA has an advocate who's based out of Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. That was a dream of mine when I was working there. We turned our crisis line from a pager system to a live answer 24-hour crisis line. We expanded our programs into two rural counties. We created two new sexual assault response teams. So it really was a lot of building while I was at that organization in Kansas City. So I really see my role there as laying the groundwork for what the advocacy program became. In many communities, advocates aren't utilized. So I can look back at that particular community and I can feel very proud of the growth that the advocacy department has undergone. But I can look at dozens of other communities across the United States where advocates are not in the room. They're not at the table because they're really not allowed to be there. And I always want to recognize that and validate that, because that is one of advocates' biggest concerns on a national perspective, is they're not even invited to be in the room. I think it would be a disservice not to talk about the fact that programs across the country are facing cuts to the VOCA Act. VOCA is Victims of Crime Act, and it is a major funder for program services for rape crisis centers, domestic violence shelters, all across the country. And pretty much across the board, everyone is facing major, major cuts. I've been working with Iwawi for the past 13 years. I started with Iwawi because my family left the Kansas City area. I left my advocacy position there. We moved to California and I wanted to stay in the field, but I also needed to do it in a way that worked with having young children. End Violence Against Women International, or Iwawi for short, was founded in 2003 by Joanne Archambault. At the time, Joanne was a sergeant in the sex crimes unit at San Diego Police Department. She loved being a sergeant. She loved being a police officer. She honestly was not really wanting to leave her field, her career in law enforcement, but she saw such a lack of training opportunities for law enforcement in sexual assault response. So she decided to retire from the police department, and she founded Iwawi. At the time, we were very small, and I reached out to the CEO, and I said, hey, if you have any projects that you would like an advocate's take on, I'd love to work with you. And it ended up being the perfect fit. I worked on writing an online training institute module called Breaking Barriers. It was about system-based and community-based advocates. I have continued to take on more projects over the years. I work pretty much solely with Iwawi at this point. I am a consultant. In the work that I do now, I manage the Start by Believing campaign. Start by Believing is a public awareness and action campaign designed to change the way we respond to disclosures of sexual assault, domestic violence, stalking, and child sexual abuse. I also oversee all of our social media efforts. I am also very involved in the training programs specifically the Online Training Institute, overseeing our training bulletins and managing the resources on our website. We're still a very small nonprofit, to be honest, but we started with the mission of improving the criminal justice response to gender-based violence. Ultimately, what that means is improving the investigations and prosecutions of sexual assault and domestic violence. Many of our training materials do focus more specifically on sexual assault. However, we know there is a massive overlap between sexual assault and domestic violence. We know there is a lot of sexual violence within intimate partner relationships. For example, we have an interview module on victim interviewing. It can be applied to either sexual assault or domestic violence. Over the years, our organization has put out a tremendous amount of training materials, again, to improve that criminal justice response. Everything from our Online Training Institute, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is virtual training for law enforcement. And it's a great opportunity for rural programs, programs that maybe don't have the training budgets, either they don't have the money to send somebody away for training. They don't have the human resources to do without somebody while they are sent away for training. The Online Training Institute provides that level of training that, let's say, a brand new detective could pick up and learn best practice information about investigating sexual assault and domestic violence cases. We also have a very, very extensive resource library available on our website. We have other programs that are more recent additions. One of them is called the Virtual Practicum, a virtual training program for forensic examiners. Virtual Practicum is a great way to do a deeper dive into other experiences like working with trans survivors, working with incarcerated survivors. One of our newer programs is called Seek Then Speak, where survivors and their loved ones can gather information in the aftermath of sexual assault. It will provide information on what they could expect in a forensic exam, what kinds of evidence will be collected. The speak portion of Seek Then Speak allows them to go through a detailed victim interview where they can fill in answers to the questions. At the end of the interview, the survivor is given a PDF of all of their responses. This is not something that sits on our server. It's not something that automatically gets submitted to law enforcement. It is a PDF that the survivor owns that they can in turn take to law enforcement to begin that reporting process if they so choose. The other program IVAWI is known for is Start by Believing. Start by Believing is our public awareness and action campaign designed to change the way we respond to disclosures of sexual assault, domestic violence, stalking, and child sexual abuse. Start by Believing, the concept for the program came to Joanne when she was a child abuse detective. She was investigating these cases and she was shocked that these children were coming forward. They were reporting child sexual abuse. And investigators were not believing the children who were reporting. When she became a sergeant over the sex crimes unit, she realized the problem was even larger than she originally anticipated. So she had the concept back in the 80s for Start by Believing. When we launched the Start by Believing program in 2011, it was finally this long dream come true for her. One of the pieces that we've really tried to portray is EVA is all about victim-centered trauma-informed responses. And the very first step of those responses is to start by believing. Every time a survivor reports a sexual assault, we encourage every first responder to start by believing that person. Start by believing that that report has merit. All too often, survivors have been met with doubt and blame rather than support and empathy. About half of sexual assault survivors rate their experience with the criminal justice system as unhelpful or hurtful. We're talking about half of the survivors that report do not get the response that they need or that they deserve. Now, the other thing we know is that survivors receive more negative responses from the friends and family members that they disclose to than they ever do from law enforcement. This is a significant problem. We know that on average, survivors reach out to 2 to 3 support people before they ever consider reporting to law enforcement. And the response of those friends and family members is absolutely critical in whether or not the survivor will tell someone else, whether they will report, whether they will seek supportive services such as advocacy or mental health services. So we really need to ensure that everyone, our community members, our family members, our loved ones, our jury pools, our criminal justice professionals, our first responders, we need to ensure that everyone is prepared to appropriately respond to disclosures of assault and abuse. One thing survivors have shared with me several times was the fact that they reported and the case didn't go anywhere. But if they were believed by the responding officer, by the investigator, by the prosecutor, and the prosecutor explained the reasons that they could not move forward with prosecution, those survivors, being believed was often enough. Being heard was often enough. Now, of course, many survivors want resolution within the criminal justice system. So I'm not saying that, oh, we can believe them and we don't have to do our jobs. I'm just saying for many of them, what they want is to be heard and believed. As the Start By Believing coordinator, I focus on Start By Believing throughout the year. For me, it's not a Sexual Assault Awareness Month or Domestic Violence Awareness Month type initiative. I truly focus on Start By Believing year round. Each community gets to choose how they implement Start By Believing in their own community. Some communities focus on exclusively a social media presence. Other communities host in-person events. They host press conferences. They have marketing budgets and they put up billboards in their community, or they have cab toppers or bus signs or yard signs. Communities have done a number of really, really creative things over the last 13 years. And in my role, I often get to talk with the communities. I get to provide technical assistance when needed to help communities with their launch, help them if they have maybe some resistance or pushback in their communities. I also get to celebrate all of the efforts of communities. We just recently celebrated at the beginning of April was the 9th annual Start By Believing Day. Start By Believing Day is the first Wednesday in April every year. It actually started out of the state of Utah. Representative Angela Romero sponsored a resolution in Utah, and that took place in 2015. I reached out to her, and with her permission, we took it global in 2016. So that was the first annual global Start By Believing Day. Every year, Representative Romero still participates in local Start By Believing events in Utah. It's always wonderful to see. I just watched a video of her participating in a virtual interview event on Facebook. Media in general plays a really important role in the awareness of gender-based violence. For example, back when I was in Kansas City working for an advocacy organization, anytime there was a story about sexual assault in the news, they came knocking on our door, asked us for an interview. I was often the face of the organization for the media. We really tried to make sure that our key messaging was what they would actually utilize. All too often in the media, sexual assault, domestic violence, it's not always portrayed in the correct way and a victim-centered way for sure. But 15 years ago, we really sought to have our say in how these stories would be portrayed. Fast forward 15 years and working for Iwawi, we have journalists that come to our annual conference every year. This past year, and I believe the year prior, the author John Krakauer has donated scholarships for journalists to attend our conference. when they attend, they get 3 days of intensive training on gender-based violence, what the reality of gender-based violence looks like, as well as what victim-centered responses look like. We have seen some incredible investigative journalism over the years. The one that comes to my mind the most is Rachel De Leon. She was part of the Netflix documentary Victim Suspect. Tremendous work uncovering victims of sexual assault who are in turn arrested for filing a quote unquote false report. There's also the work of ProPublica and the unbelievable story of rape that became unbelievable on Netflix. Investigative journalists have done some really important work in the gender-based violence space. I want to recognize their efforts. Even just looking at the Nassar story came out of an article in the Indianapolis Star. It was that journalist's story that prompted Rachel Denhollander to in turn report to Michigan State University, which got everything going. So reporters, journalists play a really critical role in their messaging, and we just want to ensure that it's done in the right way. Social media, for example, is a whole other space where we want to ensure that the right messages are out there. We want to make sure that content is with victim consent, that it is victim-centered, that it is trauma-informed. Victim consent is probably the very first and most important thing that any program that is sharing survivor stories, we need to have consent before we share their stories. And consent is not a one-time thing. We ask permission every single time we share a story. Even if we've asked 2 weeks ago and we want to share it in a different way, we're going to ask permission again. We're going to give survivors the option to review every single thing that we publish, whether it's a video or it's written material. We just had one survivor during National Stalking Awareness Month where she was not comfortable with her face because the stalker is still active in that situation. We covered her face and it was noted as anonymous. And that's really important to me as the person who works with the Survivor Voices project, that when we use survivor stories on social media or any other aspect, we are asking for permission each and every time. Social media, I think it's really been this beautiful platform for survivor advocates to share their stories, to increase awareness. And I know that it comes with some very not beautiful parts with that, but it's really provided them a space to control the narrative. One thing that I think all survivors need and want is that they just want to be believed. They want to be believed the first time, the second time, the third time, and the last time they share their story. And they deserve to be believed. When they have the courage to disclose to us, to share with us, they deserve our belief. I know that some people come back with, oh, what about false reports? False reporting is not common. The research shows that 2-8% of all reports are false. The vast majority of people who disclose that they have been sexually assaulted, that they have been abused, that they have been stalked, are telling the truth. We are doing a massive disservice to them when we do not believe them. Anyone, no matter your role, can respond with support and empathy. Anyone can use a victim-centered, trauma-informed response. Because those are principles that, number one, provide a safe space for the survivor to give you the information that you need for a thorough investigation. And when we have an effective investigation, there's a higher likelihood that the case could be prosecuted. When we start by believing and we believe survivors, we investigate fully, we can effectively prevent future sexual assaults. One specific survivor comes to mind. Her case was closed very quickly. It was not thoroughly investigated. And her case didn't move forward until the rape kit of another survivor matched hers. If her case had been adequately investigated from the beginning, it's possible that that other person might not have been sexually assaulted. So that's one prevention aspect. The other aspect of prevention to look at is trauma survivors. They experience often severe and long-lasting health consequences as a result of the sexual assault. And when you add to that the nuance of not being believed and the shame and the blame, we do see increases in those negative health consequences. We have survivors with cardiovascular disease, survivors with autoimmune disease, endometriosis that impacts their fertility. We see all these major long-term health consequences that we could potentially prevent if we started by believing.
Speaking to the people that might be listening that have experienced domestic violence or are currently experiencing domestic violence, what would you want to say to them? Any words of wisdom, advice, or words of support?
Anytime I interact with a survivor one-on-one, if they've shared their story with me, I always start by saying, thank you for sharing your story with me. Thank you for trusting me. I also say to them, I want you to know that I believe you. So to all survivors, my message is, I hear you, I see you, and I believe you.
In this advocacy, your work definitely requires a lot of you. What tools or resources have helped lighten that load or helped you navigate the most difficult times with more ease?
One of the tools that I have in my toolbox to help deal with the challenges of working in this field is walking. I walk every day with my dog. Sometimes I am processing through my own day-to-day life. Sometimes I'm processing through something a survivor shared with me. Last week, we found out that the Weinstein conviction was overturned. And so there was definitely some processing going on in the aftermath of that. That kind of ties into our conversation about the media and its impact. Every single one of those stories, whether it's about Weinstein or it's about Bill Cosby or another high-profile perpetrator, it impacts every survivor and every advocate and every worker in this field, whether there was direct experience or not. Those stories, they have an impact on us. Sometimes I just need to sit with the feelings and process through them. Sometimes I'm actively processing through them while I walk. But one of the things about being an advocate in this space is there's a sisterhood of other advocates that I connect with, that I work with, that I can turn to when it gets really hard. I can just turn to those sister advocates, if you will, and vent with them and share space with them. I feel very privileged to share that space and have that sense of community with them. I've been in this field long enough that my tolerance is higher than it used to be. Early days in the field, things bothered me a lot more frequently, especially because I was working in direct service more. I'm not in direct service now. And so my experience is completely different than an advocate who is on call on the weekends and going to the hospital. The dynamic for those two differences is very apparent to me. And so I want to respect that that level of advocacy is much more intensive on a daily basis than the advocacy that I do now. It's just knowing what I can tolerate and what I can't. Anyone can follow us on Instagram. We are at EVAWINTL. We push out a lot of content related to trauma-informed victim-centered responses, including Start By Believing. You can also find us on LinkedIn. We are EVAW International. We're on Facebook. We are on Threads kind of minimally at this point. We're getting ready to branch into YouTube a little bit more. Our website is EVA International. Start By Believing is our other website. We utilize volunteers for our annual conference, which generally takes place in April of every year. Outside of that, we don't use a whole lot of volunteers. However, we are always interested in talking with survivors. Our Survivor Voices program is essentially a way for survivors to share their story. We have different options for survivors who are interested in sharing their story, whether it be a feature on our Survivor Voices webpage, We are working on what we're calling the Why campaign. And this is something that's specific to social media, but it is a picture of a survivor. And it includes a quote of something often unhelpful that someone said to them in the aftermath of the abuse or the assault that they experienced. We have a commitment to add survivor stories throughout all of our training material. So if anybody would like to speak with us to share their story, the easiest way to do it is to go to our Instagram account. Again, it's EVAWINTL. Tap the link in our bio. We have an option there on our link tree to submit your personal story, and that will get you connected directly with me.
Thank you for that. And thank you for this conversation. I really appreciate you. I appreciate the work that EVAWI is doing. You know me, I'm always a supporter.
We appreciate your support and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
In about 2011, we did our first TV show that was a series on our family. I personally did not enjoy the experience of reality TV. There's cameras in your, quote, daily life. And really, I have to realize now that if you're going through abuse and you're keeping it squashed down and you're also being pushed to perform not only on stage in increasing amounts, but now in your own home to perform a happy family. I talk about it feeling like there was a bomb strapped to my chest, that as things became more public, it just made things so much more dire emotionally and eventually physically.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.